my first question is your personal motivations if for writing the book. I mean, it's sort of explained a little bit in the book. But for anybody who hasn't read it, what prompted you to write it?
Well, so I was sort of a aspiring writer or journalist. I mostly wrote about music, and I was living the, I guess what's increasingly going to become the stereotypical so-called hipster existence in Brooklyn, where, you know, I was working at a coffee shop and working with a lot of different artists and who were in the same boat as me, and also had access to a number of musicians that were pretty successful and that I'd been aware of for years, but they lived in the neighborhood. And I began to realize that that they really weren't making as much money as I would have expected them to be. And in some cases seemed to be like more desperate financially than I was. And I wasn't exact, you know, I was working like 30 hours a week, you know, making people coffee. So that was a big wake up call for me. And I think things combined where I was having that, I was making those observations, and then also noticing that the habits of my friends in a different way, and thinking about my own past habits, freeloading. And for the, you know, for listeners, freeloading is sort of what I'm suggesting is a better word for piracy or for file sharing. I think it's more accurate. Anyway, so I just started to rethink everything and kind of you know, go back to my old memories of being in college and my own thought process when I would download music for free, and just how popular and accepted it was amongst my friends, and how that really hadn't changed. And I was struck by the fact that, you know, I'd been writing about music for years.
Right.
And nobody talked about this stuff. You know, it really wasn't a conversation that people were having. People weren't making that connection between, oh, well, you know, there's actually an individual artist who's working very hard to make this stuff. And, you know, okay, maybe you don't like record labels, maybe you don't like Metallica, maybe you're still pissed off about the mass lawsuits, but what's the, you know, what's the argument for saying to this artist who's working their ass off, you don't have access to a fair, you know, basic fairness from the marketplace.
Right.
You know, you're going to be exploited and there's nothing we can do about it. And it has to, and it's not a problem because, you know, you're going to have so many opportunities from the internet when, you know, you talk to these artists, and that wasn't the case. But then also I really, for the first time in, you know, 2008, 2009, I became aware of these very strange justifications and arguments that people use to excuse their own actions, which, right, which I really wasn't aware of. I didn't realize how weird the discussion had gotten.
Right. And just to go back on something you said in the beginning of that answer, the musicians that you were observing or that you knew in the neighborhood that you thought were doing better than they were, for those who haven't read the book, a lot of these were musicians who are not unknown musicians. I mean, they were fairly, you had reason to believe that they were doing better than they were.
Oh, sure. In some cases they were on major labels, you know, and they were, had sold out tours, and they were getting lots and lots of press. And, you know, these were, our creative voices that were becoming, maybe not dominant, but, you know, certainly visible within the cultural landscape, and people that you would assume are doing okay. You know, you think you would never think that they were struggling.
Right. Well, and certainly they're doing everything that, you know, that this, for want of a better term, you know, sort of the tech industry side keeps telling. Well, they're connecting with their fans, and they're doing all of those things that, you know, that others who aren't even in the business presume need to be done.
Sure.
And yet somehow it isn't actually working.
Right. Well, I mean, and you know, some of those artists now I think are doing probably, I hope, you know, they're doing slightly better than they were when I when I knew them, but you know, they were also in slightly earlier stages of their careers. And, you know, but it's, you know, also I should say, it's not like I was going through their bank statements or anything like that.
Right.
You know, it was more of like observing where they lived and their apartments and just being around them and realizing like, oh, okay, this person isn't in some like crazy other category. You know, this person isn't even in a middle-class category. You know, I think artists, you know, I want artists to be making money, but it's always been hard to be an artist. It's always been difficult, and it always will be difficult.
Absolutely.
But where the rubber hits the road for me is more, if these guys who, seem to be examples of successes, if they're still struggling, well, what does that mean in regards to this larger conversation about opportunity, giving opportunity to artists and respecting their right to a fair opportunity? To distribute their work online or off.
Right.
And I think that's really what's more relevant for me, you know, that, there is no argument, you know, like, I think it's important. You got to confront individuals to think, are you entitled to free music? You know, are you entitled to take this work of this other person who actually exists, who made this for you, and to disregard their labor and their rights? Does the Pirate Bay have a right to be charging advertising on, the work of other people that they never invested a penny in?
Right.
I think those are the key questions. And that initial observation of, oh, this is a real person who needs support, you know, who's just trying to pay their rent.
Sure.
Just acknowledging there's a human behind this content and this music. A whole new set of discussions and realizations, I think, just naturally kind of flow from there.
Sure, sure. Define the term freeloading again for people who haven't yet read the book.
Freeloading. I was actually sitting in a bar in my neighborhood, Greenpoint, when it kind of came to me. But freeloading is the free downloading or streaming of unlicensed content. But then, of course, I looked it up in the dictionary after that, and it's taking advantage of the generosity of others without offering anything in return, which is precisely, you know, gets to the heart of I think what this controversy is.
Right.
You know, I think I was definitely guilty of this when I was younger, and I think I talk about it in the book a little bit, that, you know, if you're very much habituated as a consumer of cultural goods, it's very easy to be lulled into this idea that, oh, this stuff is just, you know, this stuff has always been out there. It's always been there. It's going to be there. And you kind of forget that, oh, this, none of this has to exist. None of this had to be created or be invested in, or if it was invested in or created, I didn't have to hear about it. You know, the very fact that you hear about certain things often is a direct consequence of marketing investment and marketing money,
right?
That's based in very hard business logic, you know.
Right.
So,
well, I mean that's the mindset of the adolescent, anyway.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I have a couple, or I have one, and a couple on the way, and you know, I mean, the kids don't know where stuff comes from, and that's right. There's nothing new to that per se.
No,
I mean, that's always been going on. It's just
right.
And then, of course, with this particular phenomenon, anybody who's, you know, 14 to 30, they have never known a world without the web and without access to these things for the most part.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, and it's you in the book and do something that interests me and that I try to do as well, which is to try to sort of cut through the incendiary language, you know, and obviously you describe the decade of dysfunction and that we've been sort of mired in extremes, in the way that thing, and this is true of all of our politics, unfortunately.
Sure,
I mean, it's very hard to have a rational conversation about almost anything, because not the least of which is that there's moneyed interests spending a lot of their resources on bumper sticker politics,
sure,
which gets everybody you know, good and riled up.
And the media responds to conflict. I mean, well, ultimately that's what the media wants. Of course. if there's a story, you know, and it's how this started with Napster, you know, you have this battle between, you know, young college kids who are these upstarts who are beacons for the future versus, you know, these old rich, you know, and terrible institutions. You know, that's just like a very easy story to tell that's going to interest people, but it's not necessarily accurate, you know.
Exactly. And so, you know, do you feel, I guess part of my question about the term freeloading is not just a straight up denotation of it, but also it seems to be born of your desire to try to find terms or language that might, dare I say, build some sort of common ground to have a conversation about these things.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's there, you know, that's the opportunity for that common ground is certainly out there. You know, it's just a question of how do we get there? And, you know, if you believe there's a common ground, I guess maybe that's the first step, because if you don't believe it's out there, if you believe in one of those two extremes, then, you know, you're not even going to see the possibility of that common ground. The only reason I saw it was because of the reactions I got to my writing, which weren't public. You know, they were being emailed to me privately. So I was like, oh, I think something's out there. And you know, it's important to recognize that, especially in regards to, you know, those who are sort of to the bone, seem to be to the bone copyright skeptics, you know, who don't want to, they have like no good faith, seem to have almost no good faith in the institution of copyright. I don't think this is a very big group of people.
You know what? That's my instinct as well. I mean, okay, I'll back up. My first instinct is that if you look at the American electorate at large, that it's a safe bet that a huge portion of them don't give these issues any thought at all.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't think I can walk into the diner in my community and start asking people what they think about copyright and piracy.
No. However, if you walk in and you start saying, oh, I'm working on this stuff, and I don't know if you have heard much about Napster, digital piracy, but, you know, it depends on how you frame the issue.
Obviously.
And with the term freeloading, I think what that boils down to is an argument about fairness, and that's what the argument needs to be about.
Right.
Now, obviously, from you know, if you're keeping these two extremes in mind, there's one extreme that has no faith in copyright, and then another extreme that doesn't see anything wrong with the status quo of copyright law at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so from the one hand, you could say, hey, listen, there's an actual artist who is working and has rights, and you're trampling over this person's right to distribute their work. And, you know, this isn't something that they made 80 years ago. This is something they made 2 years ago. What is your argument? You know, how is that fair?
Right.
And it's not, obviously it's not fair. But then if you're going to talk about fairness, then you also, I think, have to, you know, talk about the public domain, and that the public does have a right to a public domain that's meaningful. And, you know, I don't think it's fair that copyright terms are lifetime of the author plus 70 years. I don't see an argument for it. And so, you know, that creates some tension there. But as far as where I see the, you know, that space for common ground in the middle, that's in general where I view that space as existing. And I know that's, you know, it's easier said than done, but I mean, if there's a positive to the fact that things are as unresolved as they are right now, it's that there is an opportunity for some sort of a grand bargain between these two sides. But at the moment, you know, I don't think there's any faith between the two sides. So I'm hoping that the book, rather than, you know, of course, I hope people on either of those two sides read the book, but I am really thinking about trying to build up that middle ground of sentiment as much as possible, because if there is going to be anything that resembles resolution, that's where it's going to come from, and that's what it's going to look like.
You know, where I think you and I sort of probably are in alignment is the idea that in terms of behavior, that the focus is cultural, that you have to reach out sort of to the next generation of people and say, look, you know, question it, what it is you're doing and understand what you're doing and the sort of fallacy in how you're justifying what you're doing. And I think you and I are echo each other very much so in that sense. As far as the larger sort of policy debate, you know, I'm pretty cynical when it comes to the public in general on policy because policy is complex and the average person, I include myself in that statement, does not have the time to unpack all the complexities of most issues, be they trade agreements or foreign policy or certain law. There are reasons people went to law school. And then there are reasons that within that law school, they train for a specialty like intellectual property or whatever. It's because it often takes years and years and years of learning. So, you know, so unfortunately, what so often happens is, you know, you start to imagine, okay, I hear what people are saying when they say things like, oh, well, copyright is too long. You know, and that seems to just be something that's easy to accept because it sounds so long. And then you start, you say, okay, well, what would a compromise look like? Well, you know, what happens on day three, you know, on day two after, let's say we roll it back 25 years after a 6-month battle, it ends up getting rolled back and Mike Masnick and everybody pops a bottle of champagne. Pat themselves on the back, and then Monday morning they come in and start trying to push it back farther. What else would they do?
They start trying to push it back farther, but they have less of an argument.
You wonder, but that's where I wonder, because so many of the arguments against copyright's existence, and this is me asking your opinion, you know, so many of the arguments against it are so fallacious to begin with. That I ask myself, well, then why would anybody stop at anything short of just erasing it altogether?
Well, you know, I do happen to believe that a lot of that, those fallacious arguments and that sentiment, it does come from a real place. And as I talk about in the book, that real place is a mixture of... I think those RIAA lawsuits, you can't say enough how devastating they were from a public relations standpoint, for, you know, all big media and small media, you know, because as I say in the book, it's not as if people were like, oh, I'm not going to buy anything from Warner Brothers, but I'm going to still support independence. You know, people just lumped everybody in the same category. But I, you know, that. And you saw it in the SOPA debate. You see it post-SOPA. The people who are trying to undermine copyright enforcement or respect for copyright, that's what they go back to again and again and again. Just remind people of the mass lawsuits and how terrible the record industry is. So of course, this is all totally theoretical and I may be wrong. Who knows? But I do believe that for most people, and this is why the idea of reducing copyright terms or some kind of statutory damage, you know, statutory rate reform, I think might do a lot of good, is because it would be an olive branch from so-called big content saying, listen, we hear what you're saying. But there's another side to this. But we also, if we're going to respect this, okay, you know, we're willing to, you know, maybe listen to some of these reforms, but that comes along with, we really do need to, you know, find more effective means of enforcement. So I think from, you know, if you're thinking about in terms of public relations, I do think that would have an impact. And people couldn't say that it's all, they're all maximalists, you know, which is like a, I find that argument really funny because I don't think there are any maximalists. I think, you know, that's like the straw man that people use, pretending that anybody who's in favor of copyright enforcement is a maximalist, and you know, there's no limit to what they will do. It sort of goes, but then the, you know, the so-called other side or people who are very much in favor of intellectual property rights, I think, can be guilty of the same thing. in the opposite direction.
Well, but would you agree that, I mean, since that period, which is already going back some years, and in internet, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've had people say to me, oh, well, that wasn't that long ago. It was 5 years ago. And I want to say, well, in internet time, that's a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
We're talking about a history that's 20 years old.
Yep.
So five is a lot.
Yep.
And isn't it true that the shift has been very much away from the user, if you will, from mm-hmm. focusing on the individual user to the institutional pirate, if you will? You know,
distributor.
Yeah. To the mass infringer, like the Pirate Bay.
Yep.
That's profiting from, and not really much focus except almost by accident, on the user.
Yep. That's true. Yeah. And it, you know, I think that's an appropriate focus. I mean, I think ideally what you have is, hard enforcement as hard as possible on distributors who are willfully blind to what's going on, on their networks or on their, whether it's a torrent tracker or a cyber locker or whatever, mm-hmm. and then soft enforcement for those individuals. If the system that's going to be doing this actually works.
Right.
And, you know, so I think the copyright alert system is going to be, I'm very, very interested. I mean, maybe excited. I don't know if excited is the right or the wrong word, but I do think it's going to foster a lot of discussion and a lot of new debate. And that's incredibly positive, but you need to have the complement of making, you know, these distributors understand that, you know, it's not a long-term viable business for them. And, you know, one of the funny things that I've noticed about, you know, the folks like maybe, you know, Tech Dirt is that, okay, so the RAAA lawsuits were this abomination. Okay, so we agree, like, going after individuals is this terrible thing. But then they're like, okay, well, here's SOPA, and we're going to seriously try to do something about the distributors who are based overseas that
right.
US law, which is, you know, totally established at this point, mm-hmm. as far as those distributors can't do anything about. Oh, okay. Now it's censorship. Now you're censoring the internet.
Right.
So, that side is guilty of not, you know, really there isn't much reason to believe the loudest voices from that side, because they haven't shown that they're in favor of any enforcement.
No, that battle more than anything got me more involved in this subject. Not because of copyright per se, but because of the process. Because I found that particular process so utterly dysfunctional.
Well, you know, and I think that when that was going on, I kept thinking to myself, like, you know, Google or this community in general, they have really exposed themselves because of the absurdity of the arguments that they were putting forth. I mean, the absurdity of the censorship argument, or the idea that, oh, if we, you know, if we enforce criminality legitimately, that somehow it's inevitable that that it's going to be used illegitimately in the future. It's like, well, should we stop arresting people because we can? Because in theory, you know, we could be arresting people for the wrong reasons, which does happen.
Right.
You know, it's just a really mindless argument.
Well, and tell me your thoughts on this, because to me, it seemed to dovetail so well with other things. My feeling in the sort of age of social media is that the level of paranoia, if you will, mm-hmm. is pretty high, and maybe it's no higher than it's ever been. We just can see it because, you know, we see Facebook and Twitter go by and whatnot.
Sure.
But that same logic of, well, we can't pass this law because it will be abused in this way.
Yeah.
I have seen applied time and time again to any number of things that have come up in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the NDAA was kind of like the sister of SOPA on Facebook. And not to get into that bill per se, it's just that it was exactly the same mindset was exactly what you just said, was, you know, we can't possibly prosecute these crimes.
Right.
Because somebody will come along and apply it, you know, inappropriately.
Yep.
And I keep saying, well, yeah, but we're not going to legalize murder, even though we know that there are some people on death row right now.
Yep.
Who are innocent. And as horrible as that is, I'm confident that we're just not going to go ahead and make homicide legal. And yet, okay, that's all true.
The fashion of this issue plays a significant role in why, and also the privilege, you know, it is a cause for the privileged. Mm. I believe that more and more. It plays a role in sort of the outsized reaction and attention that something like SOPA is going to get versus campaigns to, you know, ensure that innocent people are not being killed by our government, mm-hmm. By being put on death row, you know, I mean, that's a much bigger problem.
It is. And you raise a good point. And something that comes to mind all the time, which is it does sort of feel like, you know, this sort of, it, particularly young Americans, mm-hmm. screaming about free speech.
Yeah.
It does feel a little, like an invented issue for the privileged.
It is,
you know, and I want to say, you've already got free speech. Go use it.
right. Yeah. I would again offer, I don't think it's a huge group of people that are actually doing the screaming. Mm. You know, the power of SOPA and what makes it, or, you know, how that, at least the architecture of it, which, mm-hmm. It's not hard to imagine that that same architecture could be used for incredibly positive ends. It just so happens that the information that people were being given was horseshit, mm-hmm. you know, and it was very well targeted to kind of itch at people's pre-existing biases,
right?
Which again go back to all of the, you know, the RAAA lawsuits and how easy it has been for people to just use the, you know, the record industry or the movie industry as these scapegoats, like these big, fat, easy targets. So, you know, anyway, I could see that architecture of, in terms of getting people mobilized, being used for positive ends. Yep. But for most people who participated in that, they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what the issues were.
No,
I don't think they were even, you know, they were being told that this was going to violate free speech. And because they were being told by brands that they trusted, like Wikipedia or like Google, I mean, less and less people trust Google by the day, mm-hmm. but at that time, Google's esteem was, you know, they were held in very high esteem by right. most people,
right.
you know, they were told by this, by people they believed more than they believed the record industry.
Sure.
And so they went along with it, and it was easy for them to sign these petitions. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, so again, no, I don't even know if those, how many of those people had even thought about this stuff.
No. I mean, that was the funny thing was you know, literally watching friends of mine on Facebook pass the petition around.
Yep.
And I knew that they hadn't looked at the, you know, they just, somebody shared it, sound like a good idea. And I see this all day long.
Yep.
You know, I saw one on an environmental issue the other day, and I said, you know, this may be true, but there's the math doesn't seem to add up, and
yep.
and the headline is so incendiary,
yep.
that it begs
yep.
a need to look it up, you know.
Yep. There's a great irony to that that problem, which is in terms of copyright, you know, the fact that this was a copyright enforcement bill, because, and I you know, kind of make this point in this the piece where I talk about Aaron Schwartz a little bit,
yep.
Which is that, okay, it you know, the danger of the web is that you can just say anything,
yeah,
and there's not necessarily anybody who's going to fact check it, and you know, if you say it in the right way and as you know, you reach a certain critical mass of people who are believing it and who are passing it around, and you trust those people, you're probably going to trust the thing, and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
But who is there to evaluate information and to put it in its proper context?
Right.
Generally, professional communicators whose jobs are dependent upon copyright, you know, copyright enforcement.
Yeah.
So it is, there is an opportunity there to kind of
sure.
show people, hey, this is another reason why copyright is important and why we need it, because we need independent media that is being created by professionals. And, you know, it's not like I think just because someone's a professional, they're great, but, you know, there are people who have dedicated their lives to being, trying to be fair and trying to evaluate issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, web or no web, that's still who we're relying upon to understand what is happening in that's our right. world.
That's
and
right.
without that, we're just going to be increasing, you know, more and more segmented and disconnected and, and just sort of lost in the world. And then the consequence of that is that we're more easily manipulated.
I see it as very, very hard to break the logjam of this circular logic that, as you just pointed out, SOPA in no way had anything to do with individual users. And yet the entire industry rolled out a campaign to convince everybody that, you know, if they put the wrong thing on Facebook, they were going to face, you know, anything from prison,
5 years in jail, or
whatever,
something.
You know. You know, that to me doesn't sound like somebody I want to sit down and negotiate.
Oh, sure, sure. No, you don't want to negotiate with them, but you want to marginalize them. And the way that you marginalize them, I think, is to be sensible and to take fairness seriously.
Yeah.
And to recognize that even though maybe their sentiments are, you know, kind of way in left field, they're not necessarily completely wrong about everything. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be looking for better ideas. I mean, if we believe that copyright is an important institution, as I certainly do, I think it's, I mean, something I wasn't aware of is when I was younger, certainly, but you know, when I was writing the book and thinking more and more about it, I was thinking, like, God, it's sort of amazing that also, like, copyright didn't have to exist. You know, this idea that artists, independent artists, could be given this kind of agency to do what they want, and, you know, that give and then give the power to the consumer in the market to decide which creativity was worthwhile. I mean, what a development for human civilization. So, you know, and if you want to see copyright, you know, prosper and you know, create a world. And I think now that we have the internet, the potentials for copyright are even greater than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to see a system that's fair for everybody, or as fair as reasonably fair. Right?
Right.
So, you know, people disagree, but I, you know, when I look at the issue, I think there is a political element to it. You know, if you do kind of offer some kind of olive branch, maybe the extremists aren't gonna bite. But I don't know. I don't think that, as I said before, I just don't think that's a very big group of people. I don't believe many people think of themselves as wanting to participate in the problem.